Well, I guess I could say, Dave, that things got a little hairy today, but I don't think Paul Diamond would appreciate that. I know I wouldn't appreciate it if...
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, Greetings from Allentown is not taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 165 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson. And today, as part of my seemingly never-ending quest to find wrestling that I just love and enjoy to keep myself going through these troubled times, of course I'm going to go back to Memphis, Tennessee, and I'm going to pick a different year that I have not covered to this point, 1986 in Memphis. June 7th edition of Championship Wrestling. I had said June 8th at the end of last week's show. I don't know exactly what got into me, but what I think it might have been is this episode of CWA Championship Wrestling is also the June 8th, 2019 edition of Jerry Lawler's Classic Memphis Wrestling, which is aired on Facebook and maybe other places as well. I think it all links in to YouTube, but there is a Facebook channel that had been airing that where Lawler just kind of hosts the show via wraparounds from a casino down in Mississippi. Obviously, I don't think any of those casinos are open, but who knows what happens between now and Thursday when this show is released. So I always said I love Memphis wrestling. It's one of those things where I feel like I can dip in at any period in time and kind of figure out what's going on, although I had a little bit tougher time with a certain elements in this show because there were some changes going on in Memphis in 1986, and they were trying a lot of new and interesting things, which is par for the course because they would always try to innovate just to, you know, keep things going. So before I get into all that, why don't I get my plugs? You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. That is @GFAllentownPod. You know, I probably haven't been tweeting as much, but it goes back to my general malaise. Actually, Jimmy Carter never said malaise. He had that word attached to him somehow, and I'm not entirely sure. I think somebody described it as a malaise on the country, but in any event, I probably should tweet a little bit more. So I've been tweeting more from my civilian account, but it's basically analysis of 1980s Celtics games. So if that interests you, you know, you can probably find me rather easily. Oh, and don't forget to leave a review, Greetings from Allentown, on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, or wherever fine reviews are accepted. And 5 stars is generally appreciated, although sometimes people like to give other reviews, and this is something that I've joked about with my friend Merrill for a very long time. He actually came up with the concept because as a traveler of the world, he likes to read Travelocity or whatever reviews for places that he's going. Like when he went to South Africa 7 years ago, he wanted to find out about places there. He's been to China. And what he enjoys, and by extension me as well, is the 2-star review. In any sort of platform, whether you're traveling somewhere or if it's for a podcast, let's say, because the 2-star review means you don't hate it to the point where you're only going to give it 1 star, and you're not giving it 5 stars, which is the way most people would do it, because if you know they're fired up enough to leave a review. We live in a culture where it is 1-star, 5-star. And there's absolutely no shades of gray. Now, sometimes you'll get a 3, sometimes you'll get a 4, but it's that rare 2-star review. The all-time champion of that is the Great Wall of China. Somebody gave it 2 stars and wrote for the review. It's just a big wall. Like, what the hell were you expecting? Another two-star review of the Eiffel Tower said, there are too many tourist trap trinket places near the Eiffel Tower. Well, what the hell do you think it's going to be? They're going to set those up where the people actually are. What do you think? They're going to go to the freaking outskirts of Paris where, like, nobody is outside, you know, some winery somewhere? Give me a freaking break. Which brings me back to my first two-star review that I received. It's absolutely thrilling to receive this kind of feedback from somebody who doesn't even leave even a semblance of a name, leaving the name of a fictional character from Dawson's Creek. And it goes, I don't know why the hell I'm doing this, because I really don't care at all, but it's just funny that you would leave a two-star review in this day and age. I really like the idea for the show, but the execution is poor. The host is borderline unlistenable. Maybe create a second podcast for the rambling personal monologues and keep this one about the wrestling show being reviewed. The runtime would be cut by half by removing the uninteresting tangents. Why don't you eat my ass, okay? I love your review, but why don't you suck my... If you listen to my first couple of shows that I did here, it was mostly me droning on, like, Harley Race left the AWA, he had come in for the WrestleRock show and turned up in WWF in May of 86, debuting in Toronto. I was like, how many times can I freaking do that? Because I'm going to do other shows with Harley Race, maybe even in the year 1986. So I got to figure out other stuff to talk about, incorporate the things around me into maybe putting together an entertaining podcast. Well, maybe you don't like it, but that's fine. That's fine with me. I make no bones about the fact that I am not in this to build some sort of Patreon network and become rich off this. If I were to lose my job, would that perhaps be an option? Maybe, but I would not expect big things out of it. This is freaking wrestling podcasting we're talking about here. There's 3 trillion of these freaking things, and they're all talking about basically the same stuff. Some of them even say stuff like, oh, Bray Wyatt is awesome. What a creative force. You a third time. Because I'm not going to be like all these other podcasts where I'm going to be all stuck up about my wrestling knowledge or just spend these long tracts of time during your podcast saying how great you are. It's fine. It's going to be what it's going to be. If you're listening to this show, I thank you. I thank you every single week for it. But I'm not under any illusion here that I'm doing this podcast for some higher purpose or for money. I do this because it's fun. And because I enjoy doing it. Now, do I like watching certain wrestling as much as I did in the past? Absolutely not. I cannot stand watching modern product. And I have to go back and just cut that out of my life entirely. I'm taping this on a Monday, and Raw is going to be on later from an empty arena. Vince apparently has scaled back the plan to risk his employees, or excuse me, they're not employees. I mean, after all, they're independent contractors, of course. They're not allowed to work anywhere else, but they are not actual employees. I mean, that's... Every week I have a Zoom call with friends of mine. One of them is an employment lawyer, and I just say, I hope to God that you are the hero that liberates these professional wrestlers from this thing where this phony baloney independent contractor stuff that's only there so that Vince doesn't have to provide any freaking sort of health insurance for them. I mean, give me a freaking break. Because WWE, in terms of the percentage of their revenues that they pay the wrestlers, is so minuscule compared to other professional sports. Vince fancies himself some sort of, icon on the level of, you know, baseball commissioner or football commissioner. Like, WWE is equal with those leagues. And of course, he gets appointed to this commission, which I don't like to go political on this show, but it's absolutely ridiculous that Vince McMahon is being put in any sort of position like that, considering the things that he's done in his life where he, I'm not even talking about like the storyline stuff. I'm talking like helping cover up a murder in Allentown back in 1983. And that's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to Vince. But he compares himself with the NFL, MLB, and all that. Those things are fairly public in terms of how much of the money goes to the performers, the athletes. In the NBA, I believe it's a 50-50 split. It might be 51-49 or 49-51. I don't remember from the last CBA. But they make a hell of a lot of money because the TV contracts are huge. NHL, famously, is a 50-50 split. I remember that very well from the last lockout. And, of course, there'll be probably be another lockout in another couple of years once this whole thing gets resolved. NFL, that's pretty close to a 50-50 split as well. You know what WWE pays their performers as a percentage of revenue? I believe it is lower than 10%. So don't tell me that these men and women who work in WWE, and this doesn't even go into the employees that he's furloughed and this and that kind of stuff. I mean, that's kind of a separate issue. I'm talking about the people who are in that ring every week putting it all on the line. And yes, God help me, I'm even talking about Bray Wyatt and Dolph Ziggler, the people who are just absolute useless pieces of flesh. I believe that they should have health insurance because they are employees of WWE, and this whole independent contractor thing is an absolute sham. I'm really fired up this week. The reason why I might be is, well, I'm actually doing two of these things a week, doing GFA Live on the weekend with my pal Keithy, and this past Saturday we looked at the SummerSlam Spectacular from 1991 on the USA Network. Before we got rolling, Keithy's like, is this putting you out to do a second podcast each week? And I said, no, it's absolutely not. You know why? Because this one is much easier to do. Like, I'm not struggling to come up with something to say about every little thing. You just kind of watch it and go. I have a second person to bounce things off of. So, I don't know. I kind of went off my notes here in terms of what I was going to talk about in the intro. I mean, I was actually going to, you know, go into a whole spiel about how we are so freaking screwed with this COVID-19, and I don't want to go into the whole we have to reopen the economy debate where we have about 15 idiots hanging out outside the state capitol, and then it gets shot by the local news as if there's 100,000 when clearly there isn't. All I have to say about this is that, and this is mainly for Massachusetts, New York, and the, you know, the places with the big cities that have been hit particularly hard. Massachusetts, I guess, is number three in terms of the number of cases as I'm talking right now. We are going to be so absolutely fucked going forward because there's been no help from the federal government on this. They've basically been in the way. And states cannot borrow the way a federal government can. States cannot run deficits. So this is all going to have to be paid for at some point down the line. What does that mean? That means everybody's state and local taxes are going to go up. And it's going to go up probably very, very soon once this whole thing is over. So don't be surprised when that happens. And I really want to drive home that point because I have not heard a single freaking person on television bring that up and how screwed we are going forward because of, well, again, I don't want to go too political with this. So why don't I go back to Memphis? Walking in Memphis is always really nice. The dulcet tones of Lance Russell and Dave Brown maybe will bring me back to normalcy. Now, 86 Memphis is a little bit different. We're in the middle of the year. The first quarter of 86 was very, very interesting time because Jerry Lawler had lost a Loser Leave Town match to Bill Dundee. I believe it was at the end of 1985. So Dundee is the main person, and Lawler is not there at all. So Bill, along with Dutch Mantel, which then morphs into Buddy Landell, who had turned up from from Jim Crockett Promotions after flaking out there. Dundee had kind of a reign of terror going on, and not in that Triple H sort of way that people like to say from 2003. He was roughing up the Jarretts, roughing up everybody who was on the babyface side of the ledger. So eventually, Jerry Lawler is brought back as the hero to try and put a stop to this, which he eventually does. Now, the Crockett Cup 1986, talked about this a couple weeks ago, that's a big thing going on. It's very JCP-centric, but 86 was the year JCP brought in teams from other territories, and they incorporated Mid-South. Even Memphis had an impact here with Buddy Landell and Bill Dundee working it as a tag team. They lose in a preliminary round against Terry Taylor and Dr. Death Steve Williams of Mid-South UWF. But, I mean, they were there, so it's a kind of an interesting thing in terms of how that Crockett Cup incorporated all these various promotions because they were still on friendly terms. What happens, though, after that is both Landell, well, Landell kind of flakes out yet again because that's good old Bud Rowe. I mean, it wouldn't have it any other way. They end up in Jim Crockett Promotions. Bill Dundee ends up in Jim Crockett Promotions, leaving Memphis after a pretty hot run. But as always, Memphis is so unbelievably resilient. They bring in a Bam Bam Bigelow towards the end of the year, and they're always able to keep it fresh. I mean, they even make Uncle Elmer, or Giant Hillbilly as he was known after a bit of a copyright issue with the World Wrestling Federation, make him relevant for a little bit as well. So the main thing of why we're here, why I chose this show, is the odd pairing of Joe Ledoux, who is crazy, out of his mind, looking very much like George the Animal Steel with hair all over his body, and young Paul Diamond, who has a lot of hair on top of his head. The problem here is Joe Ledoux, it's kind of one of those old guy, young guy tag teams where the old guy is taking the younger guy under his wing, and they're going to be a tag team going forward. That's a formula you see through the ages. But Joe Ledoux is so crazy that he wants to make over Paul Diamond in his image. Literally. And Paul Diamond is starting from a place where a lot of work would be needed in order to make him look like Joe Ledoux. And he wastes no time in trying to do that, which happens on this show. Now, I talked about Memphis. They're trying things. They try to incorporate popular culture into the weekly show. We get the debut this week of a team called the Beach Boys. A very interesting story on those two guys. It's actually one name that you may know from his WWF enhancement work and another guy that we met from the AWA previously. Memphis Vice, which is a tag team we see on this show that, yes, it is just like Miami Vice. They actually come out to the Miami Vice theme song. The Mod Squad, I mean, that's a little bit older. That's a tag team from the 60s. But then again, the Beach Boys were from the 60s as well. And the Fabulous Ones are brought back for yet another run, and they have a match on this show as well. And Bill Dundee, who is still very much here, he is all over the show with a couple of promos and a match against yet another familiar face. So, now that I've finally cleansed myself of the anger that has dwelled inside me as I, you know, try to figure out what to say for this intro each week, why don't I just get to it? Memphis Wrestling, June 7th, 1986.
On my own. So many promises never to be spoken. Now I know what loving you cost.
It's a very unusual circumstance where a song from the week of the show that I'm covering comes back around in popular culture, like when I'm actually recording the show, because On My Own, originally by Patti LaBelle and Michael McDonald, was number two that week in 1986, but Michael McDonald apparently did that song on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon in just the past couple of weeks. I happened to see that in searching for it on YouTube to figure out if I needed to pull just the Michael McDonald one, because that Michael McDonald songs on the Yacht Rock channel on Sirius are the combination of two of my wife's absolute least favorite things. She has it in for Michael McDonald, and it makes me wonder how I ended up marrying her. Oh yeah, that's right. We didn't really know that about each other. My love for Michael McDonald at a younger age, I guess, and her just absolute hatred of him for some reason. So So a normal introduction to the Memphis Wrestling program. We got Lance Russell and Dave Brown at the desk, as is proper, and they run down the show. And there's a lot of names because many, many tag team matches on this show. So you get two each there. You got the eight-man tag as well. They're very excited for the fabulous ones coming up. But our first bout after they go to commercial, after the opening intro, I've spoken of that format several times. The Beach Boys are out, and they're going to be facing Keith Eric, longtime veteran enhancement talent of Memphis. He just shows up, like, any year you pick for Memphis, Keith Eric is going to be there. And the Inferno, which I have no idea who that is, and it's just generic enough where how am I really going to find out? So I was thinking the Beach Boys, did they have, I know that they had a renaissance at some point in the 1980s, but I associate it with John Stamos playing the drums on Kokomo. That's not for another few years. That's about 89 when the Beach Boys started riding that Uncle Jesse, John Stamos wave. Now, who are the Beach Boys? We have Johnny Stewart, who we met from the AWA when he was known as the illustrious Johnny Stewart, spoke about how he was involved in a car dealership, I believe, at one point, and also got involved in libertarian politics, which might not be the best idea for anybody, because as we're learning during this, the whole libertarian platform, and I speak as somebody who voted for Gary Johnson twice, The whole platform kind of falls apart when you have a major public health issue. It's like, if you go to Reason.com, which is a libertarian magazine, every single article is just incessant whining about literally everything. And it's like, I don't know. It's been a real turnoff to libertarianism these last few days. I know, we have to make sure the government doesn't come take our guns. Yeah, okay, yeah, we'll be on the lookout for that and for anything else at this point, because without public health, nothing else really matters now, does it? I was going to put in the more you know there, but I think that should be friggin' obvious. His partner is Van Horn, a name that you never forget when you see it, because for some reason, I get Van Horn confused with the Von Braun Auditorium. I always want to call it the Van Auditorium and the Von Braun Horn. Like, name the guy that. Von Braun Auditorium is the place in Alabama where WF used to tape TV every so often, including when Van Horn was there as an enhancement guy in the year 1988. So there's an interesting story in my research of these Beach Boys in Memphis wrestling that has been told, and occasionally I like to find these new sites that will provide information. I don't know if there's much more on Wrestleville.com, but it's a rather interesting story centering around Van Horn, who, at the time that this was written in 2017, he was 54, so that would make him 57, and I believe he's still alive. He started wrestling when he was 22 years old. In the span of three decades, he has wrestled professionally for only 5 years. Some might have certain perceptions about his short career, but for Van Horn, it has been pretty amazing. I tell everybody I'm the Forrest Gump of professional wrestling. I'm nobody, but I've been in the right place to be able to do some really cool and fun stuff. So that's the right attitude by Van Horn. But I want to skip right to where talk about the Beach Boys in Memphis with Johnny Stewart. Van Horn, I guess it's Van Horn is his last name, rather than Van, first name, middle name Van, and last name Horn, who was newly married, and because he believed in what he was doing and the promoter was finally giving him and his partner the push they were looking for, he quit his full-time job hoping that this opportunity would turn into something promising. The Beach Boys were on the road fulfilling their wrestling commitments, and because Beach Boys wear jams, colorful cotton, knee-high shorts, Van Horn and Stewart wore them when they were wrestling. Stewart was about 230 pounds and had a stocky build, so his body did not adapt well to the restricted material that the jams had to offer. For the second night in a week, he split the seat out from his wrestling shorts. Well, you know, it can happen to anybody. I mean, Ole Anderson at the last Battle of Atlanta when he's fighting Paul Ellering after the Rich and Sawyer cage match. Possible reason why that might have been suppressed. Ole got his hands on it and didn't want people to see him wrestling with his pants split. So there's a problem, I guess, with the gear. And we were walking down the hallway, passed by Jerry Lawler's dressing room. John ducks his head in and says, "Hey, King, do you think we can, instead of wearing these jams, we can wear spandex or something else? Because these things aren't very athletic, and I keep ripping them out," said Van Horn. Jerry said, "Let me think about it, and I'll come see you in a minute." Lawler was booking for Championship Wrestling at the time. After 5 minutes had passed, he met the Beach Boys, who were in the dressing room changing out of their wrestling attire. Jerry says, "John, I thought about what you said. How about I just fire you tonight?" "Our chins hit the ground," said Van Horn. Jerry replied, "The day somebody with five matches wants to tell me anything about this business will never happen." So, there you go. I mean, maybe Lawler's overreacting a little bit in that story, and any pro wrestling story like that needs to be taken with a grain of salt. But with that story in mind, that's how I'm kind of watching this match. As they come to the ring to the song "I Get Around," which is the Beach Boys song from 1963, so there's plenty of age on that one. Again, this is their apparent debut, and they are in the beachwear as described in the story. They also look pretty small, which is not a huge deal in Memphis. Yeah, Stewart's a little bit stockier, but For whatever reason, they don't look like big guys at all. But we're not WWF here, so it doesn't really matter. A sunset flip on Eric gets a zero count by Van Horn, which was kind of funny, where he kicks out prior to the referee even going down for the count. As he gets his arm worked, a double back elbow, Keith Eric does. Double back elbow by the Beach Boys. Corner whip, head scissors by Stewart. That was a little bit awkward looking. I don't think he had been in the business that long. Inferno gets in there and gets arm dragged three times. And then a interesting looking round kick that Lance Russell comments upon. And then a very bad looking front suplex by Van Horn. It did not look particularly well executed. Similar to like what you'd see the one man gang do around this time. Arn Anderson, I guess he called it the Gourd Buster or whatever. Clothesline and the double drop kick finishes for any, you know, sort of fancy boy tag team. I guess that's a good enough finish. But to tie it back to the story at the beginning, is I was not impressed with these guys in the ring. They didn't really do it for me. So if anything, maybe Lawler, and obviously they had wrestled in the gear by this point, maybe Lawler had just decided to cut bait and like, all right, these guys are not going to work, so I'm going to send a message. And the story goes on to say that they worked for a little bit while more in Memphis, but it did not work out the way that everybody might have hoped.
Well, I'll tell you, man, the key basic about wrestling is fast motion in the ring. You know, when we met at Malibu Beach, we looked all over the world for the best tag team competition. And it's right here. You got the Mod Squad. You got Lawler and the Hillman. You got Rogers and Fargo. You got everybody. And we're looking for tag team competition. And we're looking for those world straps.
Take a lot of it, Van.
Yes, sir. We're just glad to be here in this area. You know, we've been around. We came through towns and towns. We've adopted California as a home. Took up a little bit of a new style. We're just glad to be here, Mr. Russell. See a lot of beautiful women out here. Woo! We're glad we're here today. Good to see you all.
They sound very much like the store brand version of any number of different tag teams that they're kind of trying to emulate, like the Rock and Roll Express or the Fabulous Ones, or even the way that the Rockers would be a little bit later. There's certain elements of all that, the Fantastics, that all go into it. But there's nothing there to really excite you about these guys going forward, which is why, you know, Memphis just tries stuff, and if it doesn't work, well, then you cut bait. So we go to the next team that's out, is Memphis Vice, who are out to the Miami Vice theme song, Jerry Bryant and Lou Winston. Jerry Bryant, just, I'm always depressed when I look up those guys and find out that they died at like age 36 in 1989, as Jerry Bryant did. And they, kind of like me, not very impressed with the Beach Boys.
We're going to send these boys packing, you understand?
I can't believe this. That's a real fine excuse for a human being for wrestlers, the Beach Boys.
That is they got to win.
They got to win. They look like punks. We're going to have these boys out of here before you know it.
Lou Winston isn't exactly going to be facing Lawler or Dundee in the Mid-South Coliseum one-on-one at any point in the near future, but from a charisma perspective and just the way he strikes me, he has it all, just himself, all over either of the guys in the Beach Boys. But again, I gotta hand it to Memphis, because They're trying stuff here. I mean, even if you're like, oh, you're ripping off Miami Vice. I mean, it's fine. They're always, like I said, they're always willing to incorporate popular culture. Miami Vice is a top 10 show in the 85-86 TV season. It was pretty much about as popular as it would get. So, and this team lasted for a little while. I mean, not the entirety of that series, but, you know, you kind of piggyback off stuff and get away with it. I don't know if Miami Vice had some sort of special popularity in the city of Memphis. I would tend to doubt it, and it's just something that you're kind of thinking about from a national perspective. Now, they head to the ring, and they're facing a fellow by the name of Benny Traylor. Very odd enhancement name for him. And Jerry Garman, who is not, it's spelled differently, so he's not using a Garmin GPS. I remember I used to be obsessed with those things, and then I realized, oh yeah, there's one of these in my phone that's way better because it's way more accurate in terms of predicting the traffic. Not that that's a big deal these days, because where the hell am I going to go? As Lou Winston starts out, the back of the tights of the Memphis Vice, kind of rhymes, I guess. Very interesting, because one of them has totally written on their ass, and the other one has awesome written on their ass. It reminded me, again, I've just been watching a lot of the television show 30 Rock, and there's an episode, I think, of the third season where Jenna Maroney and Tracy Jordan decide to become problem solvers, and one of them wears a shirt that says problem, and the other one says solvers. And eventually it devolves into both of them just wearing the shirt that says problem, and there's no solver at all. As Winston, I don't know, maybe it's that I just like his last name, although there's one too many letters, I guess, in it. Vertical suplex and a big boot that looked good. Maybe I'm thinking of incorporating for the big boot a sort of Sawyer DiBiase style scale for big boots. I'm not sure who I would name it after. I'm initially inclined to say the Barbarian, because he was pretty good at it. Bryant gets in there, hits a big clothesline, one body slam, and then an elbow off the second rope finishes. So another quick tag team match here as the 1-2-3 hits. But not a bad idea. I mean, there's no need for these things to go 5 or 6 minutes. Memphis, the way they do things, there's not going to be a little inset promo in the corner where the Beach Boys are going to respond to these allegations. Just get them out there, make them look good for 2 minutes, and that's certainly enough. You can't really argue with the success that Memphis had as a territory lasting as long as they did.
That's when Joe LeDuc will be involved in a big match
with
Paul Diamond.
The people know that Joe LeDuc's going to be there. The people know that Joe LeDuc does what he says he does. Paul Diamond, I told you I make you look like a man. You do look like a man now with short hair, even though if you're ugly. But don't go crying to your mama and say, oh, Joe LeDuc cut my hair. You want to slap some people around, just show up Wednesday night in Evansville.
This is the point of the show where I became very confused by what Joe LeDuc was talking about, and not because he's just sort of a crazy, out there sort of character. A Canadian lumberjack gone rogue, let's say. But he's referring to cutting Paul Diamond's hair, which does not take place until later on in this show. So I thought to myself, is this some sort of error in terms of when they put everything in? I couldn't quite figure it out. My best guess is that, like a lot of these Memphis shows that are on YouTube, it's taken from the Evansville, Indiana market. And I think it's possible that Evansville was getting episodes 1 week behind when it would air in Memphis. But I'm not entirely sure of that, which would explain the lag, because the angle was kind of done suddenly. I did post a tweet trying to crowdsource to see if I could get any answer on that. And I'm just kind of making the best guess at it than I can. I do want to take a second, because this is something that I saw last night on Twitter. Unfortunate news that Scott Bowden, the former USWA manager in Memphis, historian, podcaster, he passed away. He was only 48 years old. And I never got a chance to podcast with him, but I've heard many of his podcasts, Kentucky Fried Wrestling, but I'm much more familiar with all the things that he's written over the years on Memphis wrestling. I think KentuckyFriedWrestling.com, I believe, is the website. But anytime you do a search for, if you want to learn something about Memphis wrestling, it would take you to something that he wrote over the years. So it's very sad that he's now passed away. And, you know, with Joe Pettisino and Howard Finkel, this has not been the greatest week in the world for people who liked professional wrestling in the 80s, 90s, and I guess all the way up to today. So the Mod Squad is out next, and they're going to be taking on Giant Hillbilly, who's Uncle Elmer, which when we call him Giant Hillbilly, I think of the character from The Simpsons again, but that was actually Dr. Hillbilly versus the Iron Yuppie. So the Mod Squad has a manager, J.D. Costello, who I referred to earlier, who does a lot of the talking here, and you can tell that there are elements borrowed from other people in the business. And with it being 1986, some of this is going to be from, you know, guys from the past and a guy from the future. It's like he's the down-market version, or again, that the generic brand of Jim Cornette combined with like a dash of Brother Love thrown in there, just kind of in the way that he talks.
So this is the moment I've been waiting for. This just tickles me to death. I'm going to do two things, and that's all I'm going to tell you about. The first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to body slam the giant blob. Then I'm going to get up on that second rope and come down with the fist on Jerry Lawler, and it's all going to be done and over.
1986 was pretty much the 1 year for J.D. Costello in Memphis, and they're still trying to find their way, figure out how can we get a new Jimmy Hart in here. Of course, he had departed over a year before this for the WWF. And having that heel man, that one heel manager in a territory, no matter where it is so critically important, because they're kind of like a linchpin that you can build that one side of the ledger. All the heels, you can kind of just build around that. Or to be Heenan in the AWA, or Jimmy Hart in Memphis. Those are the two prime examples that I think of. I mean, WWF had the three wise men, and then you would assign guys based on, you know, the type of personality or character they were. But back to Costello, my suspicion of him striking me as a Jim Cornette type character was actually correct. So my suspicion was correct, because he referred to his stable as the J.D. Costello Dynasty. Now, very early in Jim Cornette's career, he was in this place called GCW Superstars from 1983 that is apparently this horrific show. I've seen one episode of it. There are not very many out there. In fact, who knows if it's even still on YouTube. Cornette referred to his crew as the Dynasty as well previous to that. So Costello never quite made it to that level, but it's like I've been saying this whole show, Memphis is not afraid to try stuff, and if it doesn't work, well, you can just move on to the next guy. And Bill Dundee is here. He's got issues with Buddy Landell now after their alliance earlier in the year, and he does a promo for Evansville, but I don't want to focus on that, because when they come back to the studio, Dundee is there as well. Now, he's a guy that, as much as I've expressed my love for Memphis, ooh, I hit my empty beer glass there and it made just really kind of an odd sound. I haven't had the same love for Bill Dundee as I've had for Lawler. Now, that might be that I've picked more episodes where Lawler is there rather than Dundee. I think that there might be some sort of selection bias there. But I think that Lawler is a bigger figure in Memphis wrestling than Bill Dundee is. But I'm not going to sell the guy short, especially as a booker. Here's a guy who was responsible for booking 1984 Mid-South. Now, your critique of Bill Dundee might be, well, he burned through angles too fast. Like, well, that may be true, but he may have burned through angles fast knowing that he wasn't going to be there for let's say, 3 years, like Dusty Rhodes booking in Jim Crockett Promotions. Actually, Dusty was booking for, I think, 4 years, come to think of it, all through the 80s. So, I don't know. I was going to say selling Bill Dundee short, but he's not exactly a tall man. But in putting together that montage on YouTube of Lord Stephen Regal entrances, I'm struck because Sir William is there with him in 93 and 94. And just thinking, wow, that's Bill Dundee. The man certainly has range. He's this badass tweener in Memphis here in 86, not to mention all the other iterations of Bill Dundee that we've seen in the Memphis territory over the years. But now he's playing this proper Englishman in WCW in the 90s. I mean, yeah, he definitely does have range. And I kind of agree with him because as a tweener, he's taking shots at everybody, whether it be Landell or even crapping on the Beach Boys.
All you young ladies out there, get on your telephone and call somebody and tell them the superstar's standing out here, because we have looked at nothing but boys. We have looked at nothing like the Beach Boys. I ain't taking nothing of them. They're cute. I hope I get to wrestle them one day so I can beat their brains in. They're a good, what do you call them, young team coming into the business. That's fine, guys. You look very nice in your little boxer shorts or whatever. But when you want to get tired of fooling with a man, look up the superstar. Now, getting back to what my ex-partner. Hey, get the camera down here, Daddy. This is what it's all about. Budro, it took me a long time, Jack. It took me a long time, Daddy, to figure this out. Now, I slapped him. I slapped him before. I slapped Mantell. I slapped Lawler. Slapped them all. And every time they would call up on the telephone and they would say, Bill, you was right. And I expected the same thing from you, Landell. But it wasn't me you was mad at. You ain't really mad at anybody. You want this belt, Jack. You couldn't stand it. We'd drive up and down in your Mercedes. I'd be in the back asleep, and he'd wear my belt. I'd wake up, and Buddy'd have my belt on. I said, Buddy, what are you doing with my belt, boy? He says, I just want to be as great as you, Bill. I just want to be as great as you. Let me wear the belt. So I let him wear it. And then when I slapped him because Jerry Lawler beat him, he gets mad, but you wasn't mad at me, Budro. Come on, let's tell all the people the truth. Jack, you want to be the Southern champion. You really believe you're Ric Flair. You think you're the reincarnation of Flair. No, Daddy, you couldn't lace Ric Flair's boots, and you can't do mine. Now, I'm going to tell you something. We're going to crawl in that ring with that barbed wire. And all you rednecks and all you hicks out there know what barbed wire is, because that's what you got around your fence. I got me a redwood fence, Jack, 7 feet high. You got barbed wire, and I don't like barbed wire. I got a gate on my fence, and I walked through it to the swimming pool.
Dundee actually continues for about another minute, but I think it kind of captured the spirit of the thing with what he had to say. It's this rare tweener character in the year 1986 when you didn't have a lot of them. Again, I'm putting myself in the shoes of somebody at the time, and particularly somebody who's, you know, still admittedly an outsider to Memphis wrestling. How many tweeners were there in the World Wrestling Federation in 1986? Zero. I can't think of one. They had everything perfectly delineated, and most places did at this time. So Bill Dundee's character at this point in 1986, where he's crapping on the crowd, he's crapping on the Beach Boys, he's crapping on Buddy Landell, who everybody else hates, and then also, you know, say Buddy Landell can't lace Ric Flair's boots. Of course, it's funny because Bill Dundee has a rather famous troubled relationship with Ric Flair. My understanding is that they never really got along all that well, which is kind of funny that he ends up in Jim Crockett Promotions then, and then, as I mentioned, in WCW much later down the line. But, boy, it's a very interesting character for the first half of 1986 and what Bill Dundee evolves into. And this is a guy who everybody talks about, oh, Chris Jericho reinvents himself. And he deserves credit for that, especially in an era now where I think it may be even more difficult to do so. But don't sell people in the past who did things like that. There's a lot of different Bill Dundee looks over the years. Now, Buddy Landell would eventually win the Southern Heavyweight title off... I'm already laughing because, yes, he wins it off Bill Dundee, but he ends up vacating it because he leaves the promotion shortly thereafter. I mean, that is the classic Buddy Landell move. So Bill Dundee is up next against a very young Tracy Smothers, although this is not the earliest that we would have seen Tracy Smothers on Greetings from Allentown. I think we saw him in Pro Wrestling USA back in 1984. I think Lance makes reference to Tracy having gone away for a little bit and now is back. And he actually scores early with two arm drags and a drop kick, babyface offense number 41. So Dundee goes outside, takes a powder, and then when he comes back in, he pulls some hair to gain control of it. And some right hands, a corner whip. Dundee, of course, has a great working punch, which is, it's like passing the SATs to actually work in Memphis. You have to have at least a decent working punch. And then if you're going to become iconic in Memphis wrestling, you have to have an all-time working punch. Because just think between Lawler and Dundee, and then even Jeff Jarrett, a guy that I don't particularly care for that much, even I will concede that in the modern era, his working punch is very good. And part of that is where he came from. So he locks in a chin lock, Dundee does. I'm not entirely sure why, but it is very brief as Tracy fights back. He actually gets a two count on a pinfall attempt, and Dundee doesn't kick out. He just puts a foot on the ropes, which I thought was rather interesting. But off an Irish whip, Tracy puts his head down. A cardinal mistake for, well, at least a multi-year veteran at this point. And Dundee, he hits just an uppercut because he's got a great working punch. It looks damn good. And that's enough to score the 1-2-3 for Bill Dundee. Kind of sort of an interesting finish. You usually see that more as a transitional move. But the punch, it's so good that I'm going to buy it as the actual finish.
Here comes Houston again. Wiggins. Dennis Johnson cuts him off. Reed. And now Seasting and Sampson. And now Dennis Johnson. And a melee is broken out here. Broken out, the benches have emptied, and they have brought police onto the floor. At the bottom of the pile is Walton and Sampson right now. It all started with Sampson and Jerry Seasting, and they're still going at it, and there is blood.
Now look, I chose this show because of the hair angle, but it doesn't hurt that this aired the day after Game 5 of the 1986 NBA Finals, because I want to talk about that little fight that happened. And I love the call of it by Dick Stockton as he's, you know, describing what's going on. But he throws in that, and there is blood, which was Dennis Johnson got cut. He it was hard way. He did not blade in the middle of the NBA Finals because he got hit by somebody. And I think it was Ralph Sampson who was throwing punches. And then when he was getting held back, he was kicking as well. Because Ralph Sampson is a ninny of the highest order who attacks a 6'1 guard, Jerry Seasting, who's guarding him in the low post. And Sampson's like, oh, he elbowed me earlier. I watched that game to gain that sort of context. And that never happened. But what's funny about it is, well, Sampson gets thrown out of the game. And he probably would have been suspended at least for the next game in today's NBA. But everybody was back for the next game. And it goes into Sampson's weakness. Ralph Sampson's weakness as a basketball player was he would come up short in these big spots either by being far too amped up, which is what he was in this game, or he would just shrink in a place like the Boston Garden and just be an absolute zero. And one of the things that I love about watching these old games is seeing maybe some production elements, like when the first punch was thrown, the director cut to the crowd reaction. I'm like, who the hell's directing the NBA Finals? Kevin Dunn or something? My God. But Sampson gets ejected from the game. Everything is heated and all that. It's CBS manages to get an interview with the ejected Ralph Sampson in the hallway, and he says a naughty word.
Thank you. Thank you, Dick. Ralph, what happened?
I set a pick down on Seasting early in the game. They're talking about getting somebody back. I came down, Walton grabbed me, and Seasting hit me, and I swung and hit him, and everybody collapsed on everybody else. So I got to say about this bullshit call. We should win the game, and It's the way they want to play. We can play like all night.
I put in the little buzzer thing because Seasting had just checked into the game for the first time, probably a minute and a half, 2 minutes before that. That took place early in the second quarter. So, I don't know, just another Ralph Sampson wilting in the face of pressure, which he did certainly in Game 6 on Sunday, June 8th. The Rockets did go on and win that game fairly easily without him, but it's Hakeem Olajuwon was the star of that team. If they had shopped Ralph Sampson, which there was a rumor that they were offered a trade where if they had given up Ralph Sampson, they would have gotten Clyde Drexler and the number 2 overall pick in the 1984 NBA draft, which they could have used to draft Michael Jordan. Charles Barkley probably would have taken Michael Jordan in that case. You probably don't need Sam Bowie if you have Hakeem there. So, I don't know. You just think about how NBA history might have changed as a result of that. So, all right. You got a melee with a lot of dudes fighting on a basketball floor. So that brings us right into the 8-man tag up next. And this is going to be exhausting because there's a lot of dudes in here and a lot of guys that I don't know a whole heck of a lot about, especially on the enhancement side of things. Joe Ledoux and Paul Diamond are the Canadian Lumberjacks. Apparently, they've had this brief alliance that I have not been able to quite ascertain because I've checked in on Memphis shows shortly before this, hadn't really seen them together. The show from the week before this isn't available, so I don't know what's going on. Very, very young Jeff Jarrett is on that side as well. I mean, he was basically a referee not that long before this, but of course he was having run-ins with the heels. It's an easy way to get heat, beat up the young guy, just like Ted DiBiase and Dustin Rhodes on that Saturday Night's Main Event back in 1990, which I just saw on the Place to Be podcast. And Dutch Mantel, of course, veteran, the Dirty, of course, as he called by Ray Combs. And on the other side, we have the Hunter, Pat Rose, Baron Von Bronner, no relation to Baron Von Raschke or any of the other barons in pro wrestling, and Don Fargo as well, which would probably be the most recognizable name on that side. Now, Joe Ledoux, you know, saying he's always something a little bit off about him. And what's amusing here is you got an 8-man tag, but he's running a little bit late because he's not there with his teammates, and Lance for a minute is wondering what the hell's going on.
And one half of the Canadian connection, Paul Diamond, I don't know where Big Joe is, may end up being a handicap match here because at this moment, Ledoux is not out there. I don't know, Dave. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah,
so,
supposed to be 8-man here.
No, here comes Joe.
Yeah,
okay. Here we go.
You know, this year, everyone's abuzz about one thing, the absence of Mark Rodkin. Oh, wait, there he is.
I'm just going to guess, since it was spoiled for us earlier, that Joe needed to charge his razor that he's going to bring out a little bit later. I don't know. I don't feel bad about bringing that up, because he already talked about it in the promo earlier on. So to start, we have Jeff Jarrett and Don Fargo. And for a second, I kind of saw, like, Fargo and Jarrett in the ring in Memphis wrestling, and thinking of it in 1986, if you say Fargo and Jarrett, you would think Jerry Jarrett and Jackie Fargo, but I don't know. I mean, Jeff Jarrett obviously had a rather successful and lengthy career, even if he's not necessarily always my cup of tea. And Don Fargo also had a rather interesting career, which I'll get into in a second. But it reminded me of, I don't know what movie it was, and I think I've talked about this before, where the poster said Stallone, Swayze, but it was actually Frank Stallone and Don Swayze in the movie. And Don Fargo is half, or was half, of the Fabulous Fargos with Jackie Fargo. He actually wrote a book called The Hard Way in 2015, shortly before he passed away. And in that book, he talks about all the various things that he did in professional wrestling, something like 13 or 14 different characters that he developed. Again, the constant reinvention of the self, which also is a pretty good idea, you know, as a human being as well. You don't want to just be the same staid person for your entire life. You want to, you know, keep reinventing. Apparently, also, he won the 1952 Mr. Pittsburgh bodybuilding competition. I was unaware that that was an actual thing, but hey, it's an award, and he won it.
That's the name of the game.
They do a bunch of lockups, Jarrett and Fargo, and eventually on the third one, they end up in one of the corners where Fargo tags out to Pat Rose, who I didn't think I would ever be able to find anything on him. Also kind of a long-time enhancement talent, but apparently, you know, there was an article written on him at some point, and he talked about something he learned from Paul Orndorff, of all people, at a TBS taping. So this must have been Georgia Championship Wrestling circa 1983, before Orndorff made the jump. And what Rose said was, I was sitting in the dressing rooms waiting to tape for TBS, and I was intimidated. Here I was, this young kid, waiting to go on national television. I was nervous as all hell. Then I realized that Orndorff put his clothes on the same way I did. It just had this calming effect on me to realize we were all the same. That calm helped me get into the ring and have great matches with some of my idols because, hey, they were human too. And that's a pretty good philosophy, although he was probably lucky that Orndorff didn't decide that day to put his pants on two legs at a time. They always say that, but like, you can put your pants on two legs at a time. I mean, it's, you know, you lean back on the bed and you can do it that way. And hell, and you know, some jeans, you might have to do it that way. So Paul Diamond gets the tag in from Jeff Jarrett. I ain't gonna do a full bio on Diamond, but most people know him as one half of Bad Company with Pat Tanaka. And yes, he becomes one half of the Orient Express later on, under a mask, with the theory of, well, we've already established Tanaka as a Japanese guy, and we can't just have him go to not be a Japanese guy, so let's slap a mask on a white guy, and, you know, keep, so we can have something for Fuji to do as well. So I guess that's okay. Paul Diamond never really became a star in the business, but he's somebody that everybody kind of remembers who he was, which I guess there's something to be said for that. He's from Thunder Bay, Ontario, as Dave Brown says, channeling his inner Pierre Maguire on NHL on NBC, when Pierre from Between the Benches always refers to what junior hockey team like a player played for, like the former Moncton Wildcat Brad Marchand or whoever. Thunder Bay, I know, has a junior team. I cannot remember what they're called. Maybe that'll come back to me at some point. And maybe they're the North Stars, apparently. Although that doesn't appear to be Junior A. Anyway, I'm getting kind of off track. As Dave makes the point that I'm thinking with this match, and there's so many guys out there with an 8-man tag, and they were fond of doing 8-man tags on Memphis TV around this time. The problem is, Lance and Dave are sitting over at the desk away from the ring, and they're calling it from there. It's not like, I don't think they have a monitor there so that they can see everything clearly. Maybe they do and I just don't see it, but Dave remarks about how there's so many guys in there that they really can't see the ring. As Dutch Mantel gets in there for a little bit, then tags out to Joe LeDuc, who is working very much like a heel, but he's technically a babyface at this time with Paul Diamond in that little alliance. Again, maybe blurring those lines, I guess, as Jarrett is back in for more traditional babyface offense. Fargo, on the other side of the ring, gets a tag and just a couple of headlocks and not a whole lot going on. This Diamond eventually tags back in. He misses an elbow, so he ends up in peril for a little bit. As Hunter gets in there, the Hunter, who is Dale Veazey, well known in certain wrestling watching circles, if you have a certain sexual preference, I would guess. But also, he was James Earl Wright in WCW as a member of the State Patrol, which I come down on them, because why the hell would you name a guy James Earl Wright? Because you have, there's so many names you could freaking choose from, and you're going to choose the two, like James Earl, which I know there's a James Earl Jones, yes, but when it's a white guy and it's James Earl, I'm sorry, the mind is going to go to the guy who shot Martin Luther King, who, by the way, has a freaking museum in Atlanta, Georgia, where World Championship Wrestling was. So, once again, I'm left scratching my head with that company. Diamond is in there. He regains control. But then when he tags out to Joe Leduc, Leduc hits a drop kick. And I'm saying, on the level of bizarre drop kicks that I've seen recently between Jerry Blackwell on that All Japan show that it did on GFA Live and some other big dudes, I was probably most surprised by this one because, you know, Leduc can, I guess, move around the ring okay, although he's certainly up there in years at this point, as a bear hug is locked in by him on Dale Vesey. Again, some of those same people that I referred to would love to bear hug Dale Vesey with a emphasis on bear. And but he is able to get out of it. We get double tags out to Dutch Mantel and Baron Von Brauer, who I really have nothing to say about. But not for long, as Joe Leduc is back in, hits a big forearm on the Baron, and then tags Dutch Mantel, who just comes in and gets the pin, which... Whew, I am glad this match is over, because this is not like the 20-man tag at Survivor Series 88. And yes, I'm just wedging in the reference where there's so many people. Like, that, everything is burned into my brain. Here, there's just so much going on and moving kind of quick that it was very hard to sort of keep track.
Saw you last week with your debut victory right here, Joe, and it looks like, Paul, you and Joe got quite a team going.
Well, we sure do, you know. Joe asked me to do this, and I'd be more than glad to be his partner. I think we're going to have a great success, and I'm looking forward to being his partner for a long, long time.
You guys worked well together in that eight-man, Joe.
Yeah, well, today's the day. Paul, come on, son. Today we're going to make you like a real Canadian, a lumberjack. We're going to... You got an extension cord here, Lance Russell.
Yeah, we got an extension cord, Bob.
Now, look, it's a hair angle, and that's going to get my attention, but there's a little bit more to it than that that I find particularly interesting, starting with the fact that Paul Diamond and Joe Leduc seem like a very unlikely team in that they have nothing in common other than they both have Canadian passports. I mean, I'm going to assume that both of them have passports. I mean, they're working in the United States at this time, so that's fine. But you can hear a woman in the crowd say, "Don't cut his hair." Now, this might have been something that was alluded to on the missing May 31st edition of Championship Wrestling, where apparently they must have teamed up or something must have happened there, where Joe Leduc had expressed, you know, maybe cutting Paul Diamond's hair because reasons. I mean, after all, he's not exactly the most... the most sensible man. I mean, just look at him. Now, if Joe Leduc, if you're watching this and you're not as familiar with, you know, his work everywhere, he is in the movie No Holds Barred as one of the dudes in Battle of the Tough Guys in that bar. At least I think. But he's billed in that movie as Big Headbanger. So that's... it's like a Panicky Idiot number 2 or Frightened Inmate number 2, whatever that was, with Tobias in Arrested Development. A very interesting credit. So he's asking for an extension cord because, I guess he doesn't have a chargeable razor. So he's just very unpredictable. And he says that he's a barber, which I have to make sure to say, he's a barber, a man who cuts hair, not a baba. So he's not going over to All Japan to work for Giant Baba. He's not interested in doing that, at least right now. So he grabs a chair, a barber chair, as is proper. And I have to admit, I'm getting a little jealous of Paul Diamond, because he has the opportunity here. If he wants to get a haircut, he can get a free haircut, where now I desperately need a haircut. My last day of work in my office, I could have walked to the freaking Supercuts, and I actually walked past it that day to go to the ATM, and I thought about going in, and I thought, nah, well, you know, whatever. Not thinking about the fact that, oh yeah, you're not going to be able to get a haircut for the next 6 weeks, and now your hair is just incredibly long. So we got a thing now where Joe Leduc wants to shave the head of Paul Diamond and make him over in his image. But Diamond, he starts to express a little skepticism.
Everybody that's coming to television, first Canadian, You gotta have a short haircut, you know, just like in the Navy. You know, it's gotta be clean cut. So, come on, Paul, sit down.
Wait a minute.
I certainly understand Paul Diamond's skepticism because his hair is not outrageously bad for the year 1986. I mean, if you transplanted it into 2020, it might be a little bit different, but if Joe Ledoux goes in and starts shaving his head, the locks of hair, you know, the sort of Willie Ames style hairdo from Willie Ames from Charles in Charge that Paul Diamond has, this is going to hurt him in the Willie Ames lookalike contest against his main rival, Dave Meltzer. So that's something he's got going on in his head. It's definitely one of the misgivings that he has.
I think Joe wants to change the appearance of the team here a little, Paul.
Well, I know he was talking about it, and I understand, you know, him wanting to wear the lumberjack clothes and everything, but I didn't know you were serious about this, man. What difference will it make if I have long hair or short hair?
What difference? You and I go in the ring, and my opponent, they look at me right away. They're not sure if they're going to win because I got a face, you know, you got to look at. So it's going to be the same thing with you. You look at those sissy hair, you know, they look at you and already they think they can win because you're a nice boy.
It's really weird that I can see both sides of this. Paul Diamond wondering, does it really matter what my hair looks like? But Joe Ledoux saying, well, you can add an intimidation factor of something that you didn't have before, maybe give you that little extra oomph. I mean, it's worked for me all these years, and he could point to himself as an example. God, I can't believe I'm just defending both sides in this angle. But there is an intimidation factor, I guess. I mean, there were studies, I think I remember reading a while back, that teams wearing black fared better in sporting events, which is probably why a lot of teams started wearing black or having black uniforms going forward. But, you know, when it comes down to it, and you're dealing with somebody like Joe Ledoux, I think Paul Diamond violated one of the edicts from a great Billy Joel song. You should never argue with the crazy Yeah, at a certain point, you just got to get up and walk away. Or in today's society, where you're not actually interacting with other people, you just hit the block or mute button on Twitter. So Paul, again, he just has misgivings, but he's willing to go for it at certain points, but then pulls away, and he's coming off as really wishy-washy.
I'm going to show you how to be a champion, how to make some main event money, be a champion. Sit down.
Joe, you're gonna fix up his hair. Take it right on off, huh?
No big deal. I'm just gonna cut his hair a little bit.
Yeah, I'm just gonna cut a little. Paul, I believe this is it, partner.
Those girls screaming are adding so much to this because it's making it's adding a certain tension, but at the same time making Diamond look like the stupid game show contestant who's like staring out to the audience of The Price is Right looking for some sort of help as if you're going to get it from, you know, 600 people all yelling at once. You could still argue that Paul Diamond is playing it okay to this point. I said, he's a little wishy-washy, but he maybe crosses a line here and kind of sets in motion events that are going to happen.
If you cut my hair, I'm going to look like an idiot. It may be fine for you, but, you know, I don't want to look like that.
Oh, it looks good on you, though.
You definitely don't want to antagonize the crazy guy in this spot. You really just want to recuse yourself from this situation. But Diamond is just going to hang in there for whatever reason. Apparently, he thinks he can work this out and have a reasonable conversation with Joe Ledoux, who apparently a lot smarter than he looks, because he's able to keep talking Paul Diamond into almost doing it, and then it just comes up a little short.
But Paul, I try to make you to my image.
I think the point is, Joe, he's saying if he has short hair, it's not going to affect his wrestling. I think that's what he's trying to...
I think it's going to affect your wrestling career, and it's going to affect you in order to win a match or lose a match.
Well, come on. I guess I guess this is decision time right here as Joe LeDuc gets the Clippers out, and he's ready to go on.
Hold on. You know, when you came to me and you wanted to be Canadian Connection, that was great. And I want to be a partner. But if it takes for me to cut my hair and look like a bumbling idiot.
Oh, we talked about it when we come from Nashville, Tennessee last week. You said, okay, Joe, you make me look like you. You make me look like a champion. That's what I want to make you look like, a champion. Everybody else, they want you to look like a champion. Ask everybody, right? Yeah. You want us to look like a champion?
I don't think everybody wants.
Come on, sit down.
Diamond sits down again, like Ledoux has talked him into it by making a personal appeal based on some sort of conversation that they may have had coming back from Nashville on some, you know, show on the road recently in their newfound tag team. So Diamond might be kind of taken in by that, and that's why he just keeps sitting down. But eventually, he's just going to be like, yeah, no, I definitely don't want to do this. But he's antagonized Ledoux to the point where, well, of course, he's going to get jumped from behind, and his head's going to go into the ring post. He's going to be unconscious, and you can kind of figure out what happens from there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, say goodbye, Paul.
No. Wait a minute. Hey, you asked me to be your partner, but if this is what it takes to be a partner, I would rather say, no, thank you, Joe. I appreciate your offer, and I hope we can still remain friends, but I don't want my hair cut, not today, not any other day. I'm sorry. I hope it had to work out this way, but, you know, I just want to be friends.
Well,
get away from this. Hopefully, you know, we'll...
I think it's fine. Better now on the front end of it than it would be later on that you get this straight, because Joe LeDuc has one idea. Joe! LeDuc took out after Paul Diamond. Well, you know, Joe, he's a little... weird at times, slams his head in to the ring post, and Diamond dropped down on the floor. LeDuc just bashed his head on the ring post.
You know what I'd love to do? And I could do this now that I've gotten the Lord Steven Regal entrance montage out of the way, and I've watched the 86 and 87 Celtics playoff games on YouTube. And now I can get down to brass tacks, which is creating a database of haircut angles through the years. And I'm not talking about like a hair versus hair match, because you can find out what the result of the match is. I'm talking like a sneak attack where a haircut occurred in some form, like Pez Watley on Jimmy Valiant, Randy Savage on Brutus Beefcake on the Brother Love Show in 1989, where he just kind of gets hit from behind and knocked, you know, beaten down a little bit, and then they cut off, you know, part of his hair in the back. Andre with Patera and Stud having his dignity raped, as Vince McMahon so famously put it. I want to put together a database of all the haircuts and how they occurred. Chloroform. Like, how did Elegante get his hair cut by the One Man Gang and Kevin Sullivan? I just remember being pissed off about it, but I don't remember how they actually disarmed him, I guess is the way to put it. So Diamond gets put into the ring post, and he's bleeding too. So he's bleeding and getting a haircut, and thankfully not in that Raven in TNA sort of way where they're literally scalping him because they don't know how to cut his hair properly. And JD Costello, he gets involved here and kind of grabs the mic away from Lance Russell. I don't quite understand how Joe LeDoux is now involved with them, but I mean, he's the lead heel manager. Maybe he's just celebrating. And the Mod Squad, the tag team that's actually going to be out in the next match, which I guess would explain why they're there, they're going to hold the door, bar the door, I guess would be the phrase, to keep any baby faces who want to save Paul Diamond's luscious head of hair.
Hey, come on, Joe. You busted the guy's head open for crying out loud.
I tell you, I'm a barber. I'm going to show them.
Hey, he said he didn't want his hair cut. What are you doing out here? Come on.
Give me that microphone. Let me do... Boys, go guard the door. Spike and Basher, guard the door. Look at this. Lance Russell, shut up. Look at this.
Look at this. Joe LeDuc showing his natural instinct. Look at this. This is the greatest thing that's happened on Championship Wrestling in many, many months. Look at this. Look at this. Paul Diamond's getting what he deserved. He's been a fruitcake for months. Now we're getting him back. Look at this. Joe LeDuc showing his natural Canadian colors. Good, Joe. Good, Joe. Yeah. Yeah. This is great. This is great, Joe. This is great. This is the best thing that's happened on Championship Wrestling in an awful long time. Paul Diamond. Exactly. The Mod Squad's keeping those geeks out. So Joe LeDuc can do his job. Joe LeDuc's doing it. Looking good, Joe. Looking good. Look, a true lumberjack. A true lumberjack, Lance Russell. Look at this. Keep that door shut, Spike and Basher. Keep them out of there. You're doing good. You're doing good. Ladies and gentlemen, the greatest thing in many months.
He barely... That is terrible, Joe. Come on now. Hey, that's enough. Now, enough is enough. Leave the kid alone.
No. He's going to look good now. Real good.
You're just butchering his hair. You're just saying, look at you. You got chunks of it all out of there. He said he didn't want his hair cut.
We don't know what he wants.
Oh, you're going to tell him what he wants, huh?
Do it, Joe.
That's sickening. Eddie. Now they got four more guys holding the door.
This is nothing that Eddie Marlin has anything to do with. This is true justice of Canada and the United States.
Yeah, he's going to have something to do with it, with you and everybody else that's participating in this.
Paul Diamond's getting what he deserved. He's asked for this. He's getting it.
He asked for him not to do it. He did not want his hair cut.
Paul Diamond is a traitor. He's been a traitor ever since he's been here. He'll be a traitor until he leaves. Joe LeDuc, a real man. A real man.
Yeah, that's fine. Joe... I've seen you allowed to do a lot of goofy things, but taking a kid like this who said he didn't want his hair cut, and he was just being honest to tell you he just well get it straight on the front end.
Now this goes on for a bit longer. I played about 3 minutes of it because he's got Diamond there, LeDoux, and he's shaving his head for what feels like an awfully long time, but he keeps shaving the same side of his head. It's not like he's trying to make him completely bald. It almost seems like he's just trying to give him the Bosworth or something, where he's just trying to shave one side, and then eventually he'll make his way over to the other. But LeDoux eventually gets a scissors and then starts going to work on the back and demulletizing it, I guess is the best way of putting it. Now, eventually, enough baby faces are able to break through the door and are able... Well, Joe LeDoux is now holding a scissors, and he's holding it up like a broken bottle, like, you want to try me? So the baby faces who are out there, I can't really identify them because they all have their back to the camera, and what they do is they kind of circle around to get LeDoux to move away to just get him out of there. But the most hilarious thing, because you really can't see what Diamond looks like, and thank God there's another promo later in the show that he gives with his new hairstyle. I mean, we're actually going to hear from the guy who got the haircut later in the show. You don't get that very often. But for whatever reason, the image, you get Lance Russell, you know, decrying all of this, and that's great enough, but you know how much I love that Memphis bumper music. And yes, they go to commercial, and four baby faces are out there, and they grab an extremity of Paul Diamond and carry him out. There's no stretcher or anything in the WMC studio. We're just going to grab an extremity and carry his ass the hell out of there because the Mod Squad match is going to start.
And that ring post, there goes LeDuc after butchering the kid's hair. That's terrible. We're going to take time out. We'll be back in just a moment. It really makes you hot when you see somebody do something.
Not that Lance Russell needs me to sing his praises once again, but there's nobody better at expressing sympathy for the babyface who has just gotten the crap kicked out of him, like directly in front of him for the better part of 5 or 6 minutes and getting his head shaved. A couple of the, I guess, co-conspirators in this are up next, the Mod Squad. I mean, that explains why they were out there to block the door, because their match is next against Billy Travis and David Haskins. Billy Travis, learning now that he and I share a birthday. Just like Jay Leno, Saddam Hussein, Barry Larkin, John Daly. The only thing is, Billy Travis died in 2002 at the age of, 41. When do I turn next week? 41. More depressing content for the podcast. That's great. Haskins is not the he's not the David Haskins who's the bassist for Love and Rockets, the band from the 80s. I just want to make that clear. I mean, you probably already knew that, but then again, we have seen musical acts get involved in Memphis. Back in that April of 88 episode, we had that country singer just chip in on behalf of that the Bruce Brothers tag team, put up that gold record to get them a title shot. The Mod Squad are Jim and Mac Jefferson, which is kind of funny because they're taking the name of a TV show, The Mod Squad, but they're actually named the Jeffersons. And everybody remembers the theme song to the Jeffersons, moving on up to the east side. But I need to shine a light because I got to play it underneath right now. The closing theme of the Jeffersons is a great theme in and of itself. The problem is you never hear it in syndication these days because they just cut it off and want to tell you what's coming up next on TV One or what other quality programming there is. I mean, there is some, but I would prefer it just be Jefferson's reruns because that show is awesome. By the way, have I mentioned that the Mod Squad is two white guys named Jefferson? Bet you didn't see that coming. It's like that old Bill Simmons, Reggie Cleveland all-star team. But now we're getting to the good part right here, where you start to feel the soul. That's where Wheezy cuts in sometimes to say that the Jeffersons has been taped in front of a live studio audience. I don't know where I've heard that before. Must have been burned into my brain. They're motorcycle cops, too. The Jeffersons. I'm going to call them the Jeffersons, even though they're actually the Mod Squad. But motorcycle cops, just like the State Patrol of Dale Vesey in it. The second State Patrol reference in this episode. I did not see that coming. And they're the Southern Tag Team Champions at this point. I guess it's the AWA Southern Tag Team Champions is the official name. And they actually beat the Fantastics for those belts. So it wasn't like some Memphis team that you may not have heard of. And they would end up losing these titles in June to the odd team of Jerry the King Lawler and Giant Hillbilly. Although I guess it's not that odd because they're pairing up all the time. As what the two Jeffersons are Basher. Well, one of them is named Basher, and he starts out with Billy Travis, who is definitely on that Lanny Poffo level. I'm going to hold my Lanny Poffo jokes because I made enough of them on the Place to Be podcast the other night. The level where you get the two enhancement guys teaming up, and one of them is going to be much better than the other one. Like when Ronnie Garvin inexplicably started teaming with jobbers in the summer of 1990. I love that one match where it's Garvin and some jobber against Rhythm and Blues. Garvin was locked up with Valentine. Like, what the hell happened to you, man? You used to have blonde hair. What happened? And hip tosses, you know, your usual babyface offense. Tag out to Haskins, who ends up in the wrong corner. As Costello, J.D. Costello is the manager of the Mod Squad. So, you know, it makes sense. Cornette's the manager of the big tag team in whatever territory he's in. So it makes sense if you're going to create the store brand, Jim Cornette, in J.D. Costello. The only problem is, as a talker, I commented on how it's like part brother love, part Cornette imitation. Here he just screws up a very sort of common saying.
You know what? This guy doesn't know the difference between a wrist watch and a wrist hold. Look at him.
It's the difference between a wrist watch and a wrist lock, but thanks for coming, JD. I really appreciate you having here. As Haskins gets slammed a few times, not exactly the dynamic offense from Basher and the other one, which I wrote down his name somewhere, but I can't even read my own handwriting, and I gotta admit, I really don't give a crap at this point. I mean, they're not exactly impressing me. This has not been a good week for tag teams, you know, really impressing me, I guess. I mean, there's too many people in the eight-man tag, in my opinion. As Haskins gets slammed a few times, tossed outside, then tossed back in, then he's tossed out a second time, and he's slammed on the floor by one of the Mod Squad guys. I don't know which one. I just still can't get over the fact that it's two white guys. Backbreaker. And Dave now says that this match has gone on for a while. And I say, yes, Dave, I agree. This thing needs to freaking end. And it does with a sort of heart attack type move where one of the Mod Squad catches Haskins and the other bounces off the ropes and hits a clothesline. And mercifully, this thing finishes. It went way too long here, but at least they limited Costello's mic time. I have to say that.
There's Samson and Walton. 2 seconds on the shot clock. Bird wants a three out of it, and he gets it.
You might be like, enough with the basketball, Winston, but this game was played the day after this aired. It's Larry Bird's self-professed greatest game. And I'm going to go along with what he said. He probably played, I think, a little bit better in Game 7 against the Pistons in the 87 Conference Finals, but that's just me. That's the play where he gets the rebound underneath the basket and decides to dribble back out to the three-point line in the corner, throws up a three, and hits it. Bill Walton has told that story numerous times. Oh, God. All right, enough 86 Celtics content for right now. I mean, I could play that song that airs on the 86 Celtics video yearbook, but it's very catchy, and it's an earworm, and I don't want you having that in your head going forward. So Wednesday night in Evansville is the promo we got, and we got Paul Diamond, who's going to talk about his upcoming match with Joe Ledoux, and this is very interesting because he is wearing a hat, and the hat says Real Country, which is R-E-E-L country. And it's got little notes on it. So I don't know if it was like a fishing thing or how that was going to go. But, you know, Diamond, he's not exactly the most charismatic individual. But he's, I guess if you shave off half his head, he gets pretty fired up.
You keep saying you're going to make a man out of me by cutting my hair. Well, brother, I was already a man. And a man you're going to be facing that Wednesday night. You know what? Nobody does this to me and gets away with it. And I'll prove that to you Wednesday night.
The two great parts of that is he kind of sounds unsure of himself in a Rick Martel sort of way. Oh, I hate to compare the two because Martel's from Quebec. And you can hear elements of the accent in Paul Diamond, but he's from Ontario, as we've established earlier. He takes off the hat, and it does not look bad, relatively speaking. I mean, I'm wearing my 2018 Baltimore Orioles spring training hat, and I take it off, and my hair right now is an absolute train wreck. And this is taking two showers a day and shampooing both times. I'm just taking two showers a day because I'm bored. I just need stuff to do. Hey, remember in the show when I was talking about J.D. Costello being the off-brand version of Jim Cornette, the generic store-brand version? Well, we have Uncle Elmer slash Giant Hillbilly in now, along with Jerry Lawler. Elmer Hillbilly, whatever you want to call him, was apparently famous among the various locker rooms that he was in for selling fake Rolexes. I feel like that's a terrible idea, and this guy does not exactly look like a shooter. So I wonder if maybe he sold the wrong thing to the wrong guy one time.
What's wrong with these tip calculators?
What are you talking about?
It's over tipping. I just left $5 for a BLT.
Let me see that. This isn't a wizard. It's a Willard.
A Willard? Sacramento Senior screwed me.
Mine doesn't have a 7. I'm ruined.
The difference between Giant Hillbilly slash Uncle Elmer is, well, Morty Seinfeld is probably a better worker than him in the ring, despite having no professional wrestling matches to his credit. I'd even go as far to say that Bob Sacamano Sr. is a better worker. And we never even saw the Sacamanos on Seinfeld, which is too bad, but I guess you want to do that Vera thing with them. All I have to say is, Thank God Jerry Lawler is there to do most of the talking.
Well, you know what that's called, Lance? That's letting your mouth write some checks that your body can't cash. Let me tell you something, you little stinking, sniveling wimp. That's exactly what you are. You couldn't fight your way out of a wet paper bag. Now, I know what you got in mind. You think you're going to hide behind those two goons up there, and they're going to do all the dirty work for you. Well, it ain't going to work. You're going to have to get in that ring sooner or later, and me and this big man right here are going to do a number on you, J.D. I guarantee you that. Is that right?
That's right, J.D. I'm going to stomp a mud hole in you, boy. Then I'm going to stomp it dry, and if you can slam me, I'll give you $1,000 out of my pig farm.
Checks will not be honored.
I don't know. Maybe he had some sort of appeal in Memphis that I'm missing, but at least in the WWF, you had Vince laughing at him, which I don't even really want to hear Vince laughing at this point because he's a disgusting human being, as I went through in the intro. Buddy Landell is up next, and he's facing Dundee in a barbed wire match, so please disavow yourself of the notion that somehow ECW was like the founder of extreme matches like that in the U.S.
You know, Lance Russell, you either love the Nature Boy or you hate him. Now, either regardless to one of the two, the main thing is the people out there in Evansville respect the Nature Boy. Hell yes, I want a barbed wire match. Maybe it'll cut down on some of the time that I spent chasing him last week, and I can save some energy to knock his teeth out or hit him a little bit harder. Dundee, you all realize now that the Nature Boy is one heck of a man, right or wrong. Hey, the Nature Boy Evansville, I'm taking you out, barbed wire match.
Buddy Landell is such a great talker, where no matter where you see him, he always brings the goods on the microphone. I'm just waiting for Dark Side of the Ring, which, as I said, they're too depressing to even watch. I'd like for them to get to one on Buddy Landell, simply because, you know, he had all the talent in the world. I mean, you can just hear it, you know, but he would just flake out place to place. All I gotta say is, you know, to the kids out there, say no to drugs. Why don't we just go to our final bout, which is the Fabulous Ones, who, the interesting thing about them, Steve Kern and Stan Lane, is no beards at this point in time. Very, very interesting. Maybe they had some sort of Gillette or Schick sponsorship at the time. They are taking on Gaddafi and Strong Machine. Now, I gotta say, for all the complaints that you could make about Muammar Gaddafi, terrorist extraordinaire, brutal dictator to his people, too many spellings of his name. We needed some sort of governing body to come together and actually agree whether it started with a G or a K. And that's just the beginning of it, because once you get past the first letter, it was up for grabs. I think I've seen it spelled about 7 or 8 different ways. So Libya is kind of a big deal with the U.S. at that time because, well... We had clashes with them earlier in 1986. Libya was funding terrorists, airplanes, taking hostages in 85. And then Libyan terrorists blew up a discotheque in West Berlin that was known to be frequented by U.S. troops. That was on April 5th. So the U.S. answered with some airstrikes in April 15th. That I don't know how many killed in that, but it was at that point that Libya changed the name of its country, which at one time was they added the word great to the beginning of it, which, you know, using the word great in a political sense might not be the, well, maybe I shouldn't go down that road. I mean, but Gaddafi is famous for having very, very weird clothes. Where he was really, really dressed oddly. And I think he's the reason why when you would go to Model UNs in high school, there would be in the rules Western business attire, because they didn't want the kid playing Libya to be dressing up like Gaddafi for any number of different reasons. So at that point, with the U.S. airstrikes on April 15th, the word great was added to the beginning of the name of Libya, which was the Socialist People's Libyan Arab Jamhuria. Not exactly sure what a Jean Maria is. I think it's just something that he made up. So, yeah, you could be a heel from Libya at this point in time. As for Strong Machine, this is no relation to the Strong Machine from Japan or any of the WWF machines, for that matter, who hadn't even debuted. The vignettes are going to start airing around this time, but they actually don't debut in the ring till August. Big and Super and Giant Machine. Giant Machine was barely even there. Now, the Fabs lost in the first round of the Crockett Cup, which seems like, Don't you think the Fabs would have gone a little bit further in that? They probably don't care, but you think of them as a big enough name where, well, they would have won at least one round. They lost in the first round to the Fantastics, which that's an interesting matchup right there. Almost feel like it's that Spider-Man meme where they're pointing at each other. It's like the Fabulous Ones of the future against the original ones. They did spend most of 1986 in Florida, which would be where Kern and Lane did. Well, Lane was in Florida when the Midnight Express came calling, but that was basically Kern's homestead. As Lane and Strong Machine start out, and first thing I notice is the top rope is super wobbly. Like, if anybody tried to do a move off the top rope, they would fall because that was not going to support anybody. Strong gets in a couple shots and then tags out to Gaddafi as the Fabs assume control. But Strong, when he gets back in, doesn't have much better luck than his Libyan pal. The ring gets cut off by the Fabs, so they're doing some textbook teamwork, and I'm glad to see some of that after some of the matches earlier. Back suplex by Steve Kern, letting All Japan know that if he didn't love the state of Florida so much and would go to Japan for a two-month tour, he could come in and work the Real World Tag League with Stan Lane. That would be an interesting thing if the two, I don't think they ever did, but a team like that working in the tag league would have been fascinating. Now I should just look it up because they probably did, and I'll just sound stupid, but I really don't give a shit at this point. As Stan and Steve are working the leg and headbutt by, looks like I wrote Dorg, but it's actually Strong. It has to be Strong, and that allows him to make the tag. Everything breaks down at this point. You get all four in the ring, a backdrop, and then a double clothesline by the Fabs on Gaddafi, and that picks up the win. Only fitting that Gaddafi is eating the pinfall in the year of our Lord, 1986. Now, at the conclusion of this match, we get a little cameo from a young Randy Hales, who comes out to the desk and lets Lance Russell know that there's a change with the Paul Diamond and Joe Ledoux match coming up. Again, the timing on this, I'm not quite figuring out, but this leads to another Paul Diamond interview where he is once again hatless. I repeat, he is hatless.
I thought you were a figure I could look up to, a fellow Canadian. And what did you do to me? You humiliated me on nationwide TV. Look at it. You busted my head open. Well, let me tell you something, brother. Come Monday night, I want you that ring so bad. You show up there and that stupid look on your face, and I'll wipe it off. I'm not afraid of you. You may be crazy, but so I will be too. I want you. And nobody does this to me. Nobody. I'll go to any length at all to beat you. Chairs, tables out in the parking lot. When you're sleeping, you won't rest easy, because I might just be there. Joel Duke, watch out. I'm coming for you.
Once again, his hair does not look that bad for what was going on earlier, where a dude was shaving one side of his head and then took the scissors recklessly to the back of it. Looking at Paul Diamond, he could fit in into any number of 1980s new wave bands, which, with it being 1986, pretty good timing. So honestly, my verdict on this is, this is not the worst haircut in the world. He might want to, you know, take a look on the bright side here. And, you know, think about the potential now where he could do a new wave rock star gimmick. You know, the problem is that Paul Diamond doesn't have much in the way of charisma, so it's not really going to lead anywhere. Lance and Dave wrap up the show at the desk and just kind of, they do that thing that I always love, which is they introduce the show happened, and then they told you what you just saw, as only Lance Russell and Dave Brown can. And that does it for Memphis Wrestling for June 7th, 1986. A lot of new stuff up on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. I was glad to see the return of Mystery Titans Theater with looking at a Boston Garden show from 1986, of all things. So do check that out. And WorldCast looking at Christmas Star Wars from 1983. So that is a big show as well. As always, the Our Vantage Point podcast bringing the goods this week with episode 173. Think it is. I know that they're ahead of me and will perpetually always be, but they're giving a fresh perspective on various things in this set of 10 episodes. And this time they're looking at Todd Pettengill, and I have to admit, It was a damn good 16-minute impassioned defense of Todd Pettengill until they brought Stephanie Wyand into it under the guise of, well, she was good in the beginning, but, you know, she took it too far. I'm going to have to go ahead and disagree with that assessment. But Todd Pettengill did what was wanted of him, and people do not look kindly on him because it was not the golden era of the WWF. And yeah, was he maybe a little bit more annoying than the people who had come before him, like your Mooney, your, the hell is that guy's name? Craig DeGeorge, that other guy. Very, very forgettable indeed. And my good pal Steve Bennett on the Sportscasters, he's got an interview queued up with Keith Law, the baseball writer and former baseball executive. I think he was in the Blue Jays front office back in the day. I am pretty sure of that. One more thing that I am absolutely sure of is that people will have things to say about this edition of Memphis Wrestling in the Big Angle. So why not kick it off in another edition of YouTube Comment Theater? As always, these are actual YouTube users leaving actual comments on the video in question. We'll start with Walter Hager, who says, "Thanks for the upload. I love seeing my late uncle Danny Fargo wrestle. He loved to strut, LMAO. I should just say laugh my ass off rather than, you know, try to read off the initials. So apparently, Danny Fargo's nephew weighing in. Trader Jack 641, the blessed uploader of this. And may God bless all the uploaders of syndicated wrestling as well, weekly programming. Over the last week or so, I've been paying more attention each time Dave Brown describes different wrestlers as rugged. I haven't kept an official count, but it has to be way up there. That's one of his standard descriptors of talent. Jobbers, mid-carders, and stars alike." And yeah, Dave Brown does use that word a lot, but we all have words that we fall back on. I know that I certainly do as well. Dynamo 805 says, "Remember, Dave was the weatherman at Channel 5 and thus had to keep an even keel to protect his professionalism and reputation. Interesting to see a clean-shaven Stan and Steve." Yeah, it is a very different look for them, but Stan in the Midnight Express, of course, would be clean-shaven that entire time. The Music Fan says, "Thank you so much for posting this. The sheer goodness continues with one of my favorite angles of all time. Paul Diamond sells the beating like he's dead, and Ledoux with scissors is just damn entertaining. My two cents on Dave is that he was sort of beige, utilitarian and dull, but always dependable and professional." Apparently the comments have just turned into sort of a referendum comment section on Dave Brown alone. Nell Bowie says, "When did Ledoux switch back heel? I guess I missed that episode." And I think that goes into the screw up by the TV or the missing episode or something or other. Alden R. Davis said, "Whatever happened to the Beach Boys, Van Horn and John Stewart?" Well, I could give a little bit of insight into that. Van Horn became an enhancement guy mostly, and John Stewart ended up in the AWA. Trader Jack 641 again weighs in, "Dave added credibility to wrestling, much like the dull sportscaster adds to many broadcasts. He wasn't over the top in the least, and he helped legitimize wrestlers, even if he didn't use the most colorful language or get stupid excited about what was going on." It's kind of like Troy Aikman. Troy never says anything too exciting, the NFL on Fox. You know, sometimes he overuses the phrase, "I think he should take a shot down the field here." Well, maybe that was Joe Theismann, but he's always pleasant enough. It's not like I've ever turned off the TV because Troy Aikman was doing the game. Nell Bowie weighs in again, "I love Memphis Wrestling, but the only thing worse than the Mod Squad was the PG-13 push a few years later." I don't know, it seems like a lot of people were at least entertained by the antics of Jamie Dundee and PG-13. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. As for next week's show, I was planning on doing a WWF Superstars of Wrestling from 1987. Maybe that would get me back in the mood. Of course, I hate Vince McMahon so much because he's a disgusting human being, and ugh.
This is a typical disgusting display.
Maybe I should incorporate drops like that a little bit more often.
The yellow, gutless way they do things here.
Well, I guess that'll do it. But you know what'll lift my spirits between this week and next week? And if I do a GFA Live this week, which has gotten some positive feedback from those of you out there, and I certainly appreciate that. That has been a lot of fun to do the last several weekends during this quarantine. Leave a 5-star review on iTunes. I ask for 5 stars mainly because that provides the best kind of social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this show. Although I guess if you leave 2 stars, it must really mean something, like you've actually listened, and then you've gone out of your way to critique me and say that your podcast that you do for free, for no money, that you do for your own personal enjoyment, you need to stop talking about yourself. I mean, sure, I guess I could talk about, you know, wrestling straight up, but have you taken a look at this business? Have you seen these dark side of the ring? Have you seen the people who actually still defend Chris Benoit 13 years later? Like, oh, the kids are the guy, the cousin, my parents are cousins. Give me a break. Give me a break with that shit. Anyway, I'm not going to bleep the S word because it really doesn't matter at this point. But I love you all for listening. I really do appreciate it. And tune in next time for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
The announcers on this program are selected and paid by parties other than this statement.